This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Enterprise Biz Bytes with me, Rich Bradbury, sat across from Frida Liu. In the studio, he's managed to sneak his way in. It is, of course, Arvin Yuvaraj. He's going to give us some opinions a little bit later on about a topic that's quite dear to our heart right now. So then, hope you had a wonderful weekend. I managed to rest well. We're going to be kicking the stories off today. Oh, go on.
No, you've got sound like you've got a bit of a cold.
I have. I've got a bit of a sinus coming. Anyway, we're going to be starting off with our heads in the clouds with AirAsia. But Tony Fernandez is going to bring us back down to earth with a bit of a bump and put our feet firmly on the ground. He was recently featured in a piece about how the internet saved AirAsia. Whilst over in the UK, they're talking about limiting access to the internet. Right. And over here without it, of course, AirAsia wouldn't be who they are today.
Yeah, you know, if you think about it, right, nearly two decades ago, low-cost airlines barely existed. Yet today, they account for more than half of total capacity in Southeast Asia, allowing many people to fly for the first time. You know, everybody can fly.
Everybody can fly.
And the fact of the matter is, this boom can be traced back to that one charismatic businessman, Tony Fernandez.
Anthony Fernandez, indeed, right. Mm. So from a company with only two jets, 250 employees and millions of dollars in debt, he's managed to fly AirAsia to new flights. Today, it has 220 planes, employs 20,000 people, and carries 65 million passengers annually. They've been named the world's top budget airline for eight consecutive years, and this year, it became the first such to get U.S. authorities' green light to fly to American airports.
Of course, that's Hawaii, and it wasn't a smooth journey, but he's managed to share some of the things that he's learned along the way.
Number one, leverage the power of the internet and new technology.
So when he acquired AirAsia, Fernandez admitted he was scared of failing. I wasn't scared of failing on my own. I was scared of letting down 250 staff. If we fail, then they'd be out of jobs. And as well, as we all know now, any firm that's just starting up, AirAsia always found itself short on cash. Fernandez had to bug his CFO every day. I never thought further than next week because we really didn't have much cash. And we had no experience and we had two planes against much larger competitors and it was scary. I can imagine.
Yeah. You think you've got this wonderful idea about how you're going to save the airline industry.
And he wasn't even starting on level ground. He was starting with debts.
Lots of debt, yeah. He tried to raise money, of course, applying for a mortgage and approaching banks for credit to no avail. But he just left the record industry and suddenly decided to start an airline. It's not exactly a convincing story, is it? You know, going to your bank manager, I've got this really good idea. Yeah. Anyway, but he does say the internet was our savior. It let AirAsia sell tickets in advance, giving it cash to roll until it grew big enough to get approved for a loan, of course. It also allowed the company to sell tickets directly to customers, skipping the traditional distribution channels and cutting costs.
And I have to say that it'd be the airline that got me used to spending a lot more on a credit card.
Right.
Right. Because we'd be very wary about not spending more than the amount for clothes. But somehow with tickets,
it seemed okay.
It broke the barrier.
Yeah.
So, Anthony has been quoted as saying that e-commerce now accounts for a large percentage of AirAsia's business. I think it'd be a lot.
Yeah.
Earning the company a little more than $1.5 billion in revenue last year. So, e-commerce has proven to be a lifeline for AirAsia in recent years, with competition in the industry growing much tighter and resulting in a significant decline in airfares. A large portion of his business comes from ancillary goods and services sold online. That's that partner, Sirs Nasi Lemak.
Yeah.
And other things like checked baggage, preferred seating, Wi-Fi to hotel and rental car bookings and redemption of miles.
I mean, if you're booking an AirAsia flight, any of us will complain about why do I have to pay for this and why do I have to pay for this? And this, it all starts to make sense, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, the next is to build a good product, of course, people will buy. So, Ilya, the story of AirAsia, it wasn't easy to get people to use the internet. I mean, it was there, but like you say, no one had got a credit card or they didn't want to use it. And it was a challenge, but nothing a good product, Tony says, that couldn't take on. He says, I knew Malaysians very well. If you put in a good deal, they'll find a way to buy it. They'll use their grandmother's card in America, whatever, right? We'll find a way.
I think it started with free.
Right.
So even the SARS outbreak of 2002 didn't weigh them down. At the time, as travelers became cautious of flying, Fernandez saw the opportunity to build a brand. So I went to my marketing and said, triple your advertising now. They asked me what drug I was taking. He laughs. Because no one else was advertising, I said, drop the fares. And I knew Malaysians very well. If you bring the fare low enough, they'll risk their lives.
I mean, I read this outside to the rest of the team, and we were like, wow, that really tells you, you know, how cutthroat Tony can be when he wants to be, right?
No, but the thing is, that's it, though. He understands the audience.
Exactly. He's exactly right. The next tip he's got is look when no one else is looking. So they initially focus on conquering Malaysia. You've got to be good to your own country first, he says. But, you know, he looks at the rest of Southeast Asia when nobody did. You know, everyone else was focused on India, China. And he said, there's 700 million people here. Right. Why doesn't anybody want any of that?
Right.
So what they did was gain first mover advantage and fly to destinations no one serviced. You know, Bandung. Who was going to fly to Bandung? And then Tony said, you know what, we'll fly to Bandung. And people started getting on the flights, of course.
And that's the thing, right? I just went on a trip to Yogyakarta. And if I knew there was a trip that I had to go through Indonesia, Garuda, and to fly to Jakarta, I wouldn't think about
it. It's too much hassle.
Yeah. Then, of course, from ASEAN, AirAsia expanded to India, then in China. So it currently flies a long haul under the AirAsia X brand to places like the Middle East, Australia, and Europe. And chances don't come often, so grab them.
That's it. He originally failed to land this job that he was supposed to be looking for with Richard Branson's company.
Yeah.
He walked in originally as an accountant.
Yeah.
And they basically said he was a really bad accountant. But he knew how to create music. So he wrote to every record company and they all told me to go to hell. Virgin offered him an interview. He went along. They also told him to go to hell.
Luckily, as he was making his way out, he saw Branson come in. I thought, should I be this shy Malaysian and just smile and walk off? Or should I take the opportunity, take the chance? And they started talking. And after seeing something special in him, Branson gave him the job. And years later, they were inseparable and having set up AirAsia X together. So if there's a lesson to take away, chances don't come very often. So if you get it, grab it. Don't be shy.
Right.
Yeah.
Don't be that shy Malaysian. I've never seen you as being a shy Malaysian, Frieda, I'll be honest. Right. Okay. Moving on to our next story. Toyotas and flying cars. Right. So we're sticking with all things aerial. And this could... There's a little pun here. See if you get it. This could well be a truly Olympic feat. A startup backed by Japanese automaker Toyota revealed a rudimentary prototype of a flying car aiming to whisk a driver through the air to light the Olympic torch in Tokyo in summer 2020. Oh.
Okay. not as effective as Elon's Musk.
No, it wasn't.
Okay, I'll have to come back to this. Okay, so although the startup is not officially collaborating with Toyota, the automaker confirmed to USA Today that it is exploring aerial solutions on its own in early stage research. And some of its employees are aiding the startup on a voluntary basis. So Toyota described its own flying car ambitions as in the very early stages and said nothing has been decided yet about commercialization.
Our friend Elon Musk said that flying cars would be terrifying. I'm inclined to agree with him, I'll be honest. Anyway,
still the involvement of the world's second largest automakers reflects a serious step forward for flying cars amid a swirling debate over whether they're realistic at all. You had to put in Elon in that story.
Of course, he's coming back a little bit later on, I can tell you that. Here's a little quote from the people behind this development, though. They said, within Toyota, we're advancing broad research and development on ways of transportation, including aerial solutions that can lead to a prosperous society in the future. That bit worries me a little bit, right?
To be sure, you know, the startup venture, dubbed Cartivator Resource Management, got off to a sputtering start on Saturday. Yes, the Cartivator.
Right.
Using aluminium framing, 8 propellers and the sensors to fly, and cushioned by basketballs attached to the bottom of his frame. I'm picturing that.
Yeah, it's like something from a bad science project.
Cartivator's SkyDrive vehicle flew to eye level for several seconds before crashing back to the earth and suffering damage. So further flight attempts were abandoned. Needless to say, this was not a day of flight and will go down in history alongside the Wright brothers.
I told you, Elon was right.
Mm.
Still, the company, who got nearly $400,000 from Toyota, deemed the liftoff a success and said it's charting a path towards a manned flight in 2019. They have a leader. His name is Tsubasa Nakamura. He said in a blog post that the Cartivator would reveal a redesigned prototype in November.
So a Cartivator's formation places the company in direct competition with many other high-profile flying car ventures, including efforts by Google co-founder Larry Page and ride-hailing app Uber. So startups taking a crack at flying cars include Netherlands-based PALV and Slovakia-based Aeromobile, which are accepting orders for flying cars that require a runway and a pilot's license.
Much better idea.
Yeah. Massachusetts-based Terra Fugia and Germany's Lilium Aviation are developing cars that take off and land vertically.
So Toyota's entry into the flying car space could take the race to a new stratosphere. The company said it shares the same desire as Cartivator to ignite the Olympic flame in 2020 using the flying car.
But the company's entry into a space also renews the debate over whether flying cars are feasible at all. What's that movie, Fifth Element?
Yeah, oh, Fifth Element, yeah. That's the one with Bruce Willis,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's the image I'm getting.
Exactly.
Right? Okay, so here he is. Tesla CEO Elon Musk is a skeptic. You must have watched the same movie. So the billionaire innovator who doubles as CEO of SpaceX with dreams of colonizing Mars said recently in an interview at TED Talks that he likes flying things, but that flying cars aren't doable. There is a challenge of flying cars in what they'll be quite noisy. The wind force generated will be very high.
Right. And from a practical perspective, if something's flying over your head and there's a whole bunch of flying cars going all over the place, it's not an anxiety-reducing situation. You're thinking, did they service their hubcaps or is it going to come off and guillotine me?
So count Uber among the companies taking a flying car seriously. Despite legal roadblocks in Uber's development of autonomous cars, the company recently pledged to demonstrate a working flying vehicle that takes off and lands vertically at the 2020 World Expo in Dubai. Urban aviation is the natural next step for Uber, Chief Product Officer Jeff Holden said.
I've got to say, as much as the prospect of flying cars really excites me, until I see traffic lights on the ground that actually work all the time, I'm not expecting this anytime soon. I don't want that idea of like all these things whizzing around above me. How do you stop them from hitting one another, right? What happens when the wind comes? It terrifies me, the idea of this. Yet it excites me at the same time. Anyway, when we return, we'll be talking about women in the workplace in Japan. You're listening to Enterprise Biz Bytes here on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Brilliant Financial Mentors, BFM 89.9.
You're still tuned in to Enterprise Biz Bytes on this 5th of June 2017. My name is Rich Bradbury. Frida Liu is with me in the studio today.
Arvind Yuvaraj too.
He's here too.
And Audrey Rush.
Yeah, she's quietly
lurking in the background.
Hiding in the corner, yeah. Right. So I know, Frida, you're going to have something to say about this next story. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, has suggested that Japan consider mandatory quotas for hiring and promoting women to make its womenomics push to the next level. Quotas, Frida. Do you like the sound of that?
For a country like Japan, much, much needed.
Right.
You know, this is, I used to have this opinion about, do we really need to put numbers? But this is where I've come from, Malaysia, and it's different. And even here, right, we still have, in terms of women leadership, we still need some numbers. And it's affirmative action. If we don't even put these numbers in place, right, they're not even being, you know, they're not even considered. And if you've been to Japan in a work environment, and I have, and you'll see, when I went to the office, it was all men, and the women that you have there are all support staff,
right,
clerical staff, and they are educated, right? And so you do see this disparity of how it's largely male and not a lot of women, and it's not like they've not been educated.
So right.
It's about time.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. All right, so to give some background on this story before we move on, the Abe administration made advancing women in the workplace one of its top priorities early on. This, of course, because Japan's business culture, as you've just said, has traditionally been dominated by men. But the country's labor shortage means it's time to get more women into these productive roles.
So the lack of women in leadership positions also limits the diversity of views in corporate boardrooms. It means companies forego the talents and abilities of half of Japan's, you know, highly educated population. There is the issue of aging population, and then they're not having many babies as well.
I mean, Singapore tried to do all of that kind of stuff with a whole bunch of adverts, didn't they? I mean, maybe then. I don't think Japan needs adverts. If they started down that road, we'd never know where it'd end up. But while the people at the Organization for the Economic Cooperation and Development admit that his government deserves credit for striving to improve the status of women in the labor force, a lot more still needs to be done, particularly in the private sector. And this is not going to happen on its own.
Yeah.
Policy's got to come and accompany this process.
It should be noted, though, that Japan is not the only country having difficulty getting more women into top business positions.
We know that.
Yeah, the country's having the most success are those that legally require a certain amount of women in leadership spots. And this seems to have worked, especially with candidates with senior government positions. So a quota forces people to at least go look for women to fill these senior roles, and this is affirmative search, you know, that you try harder to find the competent women, right?
So the OECD, they've also described quotas as the fastest way to increase female representation in the workplace, but noted other policies and practices are important as well. Owner or investor enthusiasm, continuous monitoring within the company, and the commitment of top management and human resources management to drive change.
Yeah, and to think that that Abe initially had the ambitious goal of placing women in 30% of mansion positions in all fields by 2020. Hello, we're not even getting that here. But that target was later revised to 7% of section chief positions in national government and 10% for similar positions in the private sector when really hit. So wage gains for women in large companies also failed to keep pace with those of their male colleagues, possibly reflecting the lack of women in senior positions and the tendency of women to work part-time after taking leave to have children.
I mean, this is that issue that just keeps going around and around. While everyone agrees, then, that Japan's tight labour market should create opportunities for women in the labour force, it won't be long enough. It won't be enough as long as the country is punishing work norms persist. You know what the Japanese work culture is like. You're expected to work 70 hours a week, you know, something like that. It's crazy.
Whether they're really working is something else.
Right.
They always end up... It's just... I've read this article where it was just not cool to be seen coming home early by the neighbours.
Right.
They're actually at a bar.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's that feeling of guilt almost of I must be seen in the office. You know, regardless of if you're productive or not, just being seen there is a big thing.
Right, and I've gotten over that guilt. I leave it too.
I don't blame you. So
there's no quick fix for this. It's going to be a long process, quota, no quota. But I think that's, you know, it's really important, not only Japan, to keep this initiative going and not just let it, you know, peter out.
Right. Okay, we're going to take a very short break and get some ads and some music in. But when we come back, we have a special guest joining us for a discussion on our new favourite superhero. And here's a hint, she doesn't wear a cape. It's all coming up next on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Brilliant financial model, BFM 89.9.
You're still listening to Enterprise Biz Bites with me, Rich Bradbury, Free Liu, and crashing the studio completely uninvited is Arvin Yuvaraj. He's here with his next assignment to talk about movies, money and misogyny in Hollywood.
Yeah, that's how I get most of my jobs, just walk into the office.
He just wants to talk about Wonder Woman.
Of course, who doesn't at the minute? Come on, tell us.
Walk into the office and then people ask me like, hey, do you work here? And I go, yeah.
Yeah, of course I do.
That's just for 5 years. So, no, because you were talking before this about Japan and the quota for women who work there. So when it comes to things like Hollywood, Hollywood's a business and they've had this problem with lopsidedness for like a long, long time. So I have a condition called movie madness. There's no cure. Yeah, and I've, I've tried to get, there are a lot of women directors there who I want to see do certain movies that never get the chance, like Alexi Alexander or Lupita Nyong'o. They never get to the top because it's always someone else who gets it and there's no track record of them because there's no chance in the first place.
Right.
So Hollywood is a creature of habit, right? So if something works well, then they're going to keep doing it and the trend is going to start.
As we've seen.
So one way to address this problem is some of them go on social media and then they put up like videos, they put up posts, talk about it and all. The other way to do it is to go make a movie that makes a ridiculous amount of money and just throw money on the studio's table and that's it. So once that trend starts, and that trend I think started last week because Wonder Woman made $100 million domestic, which is never heard of. Like anything from a female director has never come close to making that amount of money.
This is the equivalent of a movie mic drop.
Yeah, it is. Right? It is. It's basically her going out there and saying that this is what she can do. And she set the trend because she made a superhero movie.
Yeah.
And those things just become pop culture phenomenons like overnight, right? So before this, women comprised of 7% of all directors working in the top 250 domestic grossing films of 2016. That's it. And that figure represents a decline of 2 percentage points from 2015, which was only about 9%. But now, this movie alone is the top domestic debut of all time for a female director, who is Patty Jenkins. $100 million it made. Overseas, it took in another $122.5 million. So the total for that movie is $23 million global.
Right. Let me ask you a question, right? We know that Marvel have done exceptionally well with the films that they release. We also know that DC, as much as we've wanted them to do well, have never really done it, right?
No.
What is it about this particular movie and this particular version of Wonder Woman, you think, that's made it this behemoth that it's become? Why is it so popular?
One, because they've been trying to do this movie for about 16 years. For a long, long, long time, they've tried to get this movie off the ground.
Right.
Second, the movie itself is It's different. It has a female protagonist, mm-hmm. but it's not protagonist in a way where it's a pseudo protagonist,
right?
Where she's just there to sort of buffer the actual male protagonist.
She's an actual.
Actual hero with a drive, and she wants to do certain things, and she has direction, and then she does it, and she is the actual hero of the movie.
Right.
The other thing is there is inclusiveness. So Gal Gadot has an accent. So it's not fully American now. So a global audience can relate to it because of the accent that they had. She doesn't try to cover it up. She doesn't try to put on an accent. She has an accent and she just embraces
this
it.
This is who I am.
Yeah, and
this
everyone is who she else is. Adopts her accent.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In the movie, yeah.
In the movie.
Don't tell me that. I mean, I've not seen it yet.
It's not a spoiler. It's just that's how the film is designed.
But I like the sound of that, though.
Yeah. So that's another thing. So she's not pro-American anymore. She's not a completely American superhero. The other thing is that this pretty much opens up. It's another movie in the line of big movies that have female leads. So you have The Hunger Games. Mm. The last two Star Wars have had female leads.
Yeah.
Now you have Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
The previous holder for this record was 50 Shades of Grey.
No.
For a female director. Yeah. So that's not exactly a movie or that you want on top. It made about 93 million.
I'm sure somebody wanted it on top. Moving on.
Oh. Let's on that note. And then before this
I've thrown you off now, haven't I?
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
what
you
she
have,
said.
You have. Now it's in my head. Before this, you had a couple of superhero movies. You had Catwoman and Elektra.
Yeah.
Those two flopped. It didn't work. Those two flopped. It didn't do pretty well. Since you said you mentioned the Marvel superhero movies,
yeah.
How this compares, it's actually the 16th film to cross 100 million in the domestic box office launch. It beat out the openings of the first two Thor movies, the first Captain America movies, and as well as the first Iron Man movie, which only made about 19 million. Yeah. So, what else is there? Oh, another thing. Another big week for female directors this week is because Sofia Coppola, she became the first woman to win Best Director at the Cannes Film Festival in 56 years.
Wow.
Yeah, for her Civil War thriller, The Beguiled. She's only the second person to do it. She joins Yulia Solentseva, who won in 1961 for Chronicle of the Flaming Years.
Wow.
That's some great news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but wow, this is Yulia. We have to look for her. But this is something that I know Gina Davis has this association that looks into how females in media are not paid equally. So she's an advocate of that. I can't remember what's called right now.
Right.
But just, you know, do a search, Gina Davis.
Mm-hmm. But something like this, you know, it should definitely help sway the scale, surely.
It should, because like I said, Hollywood is a creature of habit. If you had like R-rated superhero movies coming out last year, and then you have like a dozen more in line all of a sudden, because it made a lot of money, and they look at that, and then they just greenlight another bunch of movies to follow that up. So now that you have this, and it did this well, a sequel is already on its way.
Of course
it's been greenlit, and there's about a dozen movies that will be in line with female directors getting chances to do these kinds of movies.
All right.
Yeah.
Better take another short break then. Mm-hmm. Okay, in the meantime, go get your tickets for Wonder Woman if you haven't seen it already. I guess I'm going to have to get it as well now. We'll talk astronauts and health, yes, in the same sentence. Enterprise Biz Bytes on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Bole Fikir Mandalam, BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bytes with me, Rich Bradbury, and Frida Liu. So we're speaking about the exotic Gal Gadot just a few moments ago. We're going to be moving on into space and health.
This is a really interesting story. Yeah? So having just talked about this sadly fictional superhero, I'd like to draw attention to people I consider real-life superheroes, astronauts. Right, very little can get more awesome than being able to explore space, but that's not the only thing astronauts have contributed to society. So much new technology has been created that not only serve the purposes of interstellar adventuring, but has actually been used to further advancements in the medical field. Who knew?
I do wish we were interstellar by now, but we're not. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's truly fascinating. We've got two areas that have connected, of course. According to an article that was found on Enka.com, here are 10 ways astronauts are helping you to stay healthy, starting with a robotic arm that was developed in Canada called Canadarm 2. They're very creative over there.
You know, it came from Canada. So first of all, that's fantastic. But also, what does this robotic arm do? Is it like prosthesis or something?
Not quite. Actually, it's attached to the outside of the International Space Station, and it's used to prevent astronauts having to complete high-risk spacewalks. So it kind of grabs you. But the technology led to the development of this thing called the NeuroArm, which is what they use for those precision surgeries inside MRIs. So it's like a little robotic arm that removes brain tumors.
And that came from space. Okay, so yeah, it is space-related technology, and it's really useful for things that require precision, accuracy. You know, high-tech eye trackers were developed to see where astronauts look, because apparently the lack of gravity actually changes the way your eyes perceive motion.
Yeah.
I'm sure. So now those trackers also used during corrective laser eye surgery to ensure correct laser beam positioning.
Right. It was interesting because I was reading not too long ago about these astronauts that are spending large times in space. And they were saying that for some of them, for the first few days, not just the first few minutes, they'd suffer from motion sickness. Can you imagine?
Sure.
Just been sat there like the whole thing is spinning. I'd want to vomit. Anyway, as you know, it's not just a surgical method that technology helps. Even a day-to-day necessities, you know, like breathing.
That thing.
Has had technological advancements as well. For people with asthma, as we know, their lungs can become inflamed and affect their breathing. And when that happens, there's actually an increase in this thing called nitric oxide, which is a pollutant in your exhaled breath. So a device developed by the European Space Agency to detect potential inflammation in the exhaled air of astronauts is now being used for asthmatics as well.
Useful for you, right?
Yeah.
Not to mention the massive loss in bone density that astronauts experience without gravity acting on their bodies is actually really similar to the bone loss seen in cases of osteoporosis.
Mm-hmm.
So astronauts discover that taking a small amount of this substance called bisphosphonate weekly reduces bone loss, which is a pharmaceutical development now being used to treat osteoporosis as well.
Of course it is. Now, this all sounds like technology we've only recently discovered and are using, these crafty people. But even something we kind of take for granted, like when you have a fever, you can use an in-ear thermometer, right? Remember those?
Yeah.
Just push your button, wait for a beep, and you know whether or not to head to your doctors.
And even that is based off space technology as well. So the original use for that technology was to measure the temperature of planets and stars, and it's actually in 1991 that they started using this technology to measure human bodies as well as celestial ones.
Also, astronauts that experienced changes in vision were found to have increased pressure inside their skulls due to an increase in cerebrospinal fluid volume, which is an issue that flight surgeons also needed to monitor. So using that knowledge, there's now a non-invasive device that can measure the pressure inside your skull using displacement of the eardrum. That's fascinating.
Right? And if this didn't sound enough like science fiction, so apparently being in space increases the chance of developing kidney stones. So research with NASA actually developed a Star Trek-like tractor beam. So it's an ultrasound technique that can detect, move, and break down stones, making them easier to pass. And obviously, this technology could really benefit people with kidney stones down here on Earth as well.
We know one or two of those, don't we? Mm. Right. Here's another thing. I've never thought of dentist work as it all relates to NASA, but a kind of ceramic that was developed for defense and aerospace purposes was also repurposed to become invisible, so to speak, braces, as the material looks and feels very similar to normal teeth.
So on a still-developing note, a NASA created technology that helps to enhance lunar images, and they use it to find the best moon landing sites in the Apollo era. But now the medical field uses it in CT and MRI scans to help find injuries and cancers without the need for invasive procedures. So again,
it's pretty incredible.
I mean, and we know people who have, you know, benefited from this technology.
Yep. I mean, the final part of this article, astronauts actually need to reduce the amount of water that they take up in space because water, as we know, is very heavy. So most liquids on the ISS are recycled and purified. These filtration systems are now used to remove toxic waste from from dialysis fluid. And they've set the path for portable dialysis machines that we can use at home. Things like little things that you don't even think of anymore. Velcro is, of course, invented in space.
Yeah, thank God for them, right? How's that for a motivational Monday? Thank you to all the space work.
And there's that old story about how it's a bit of an urban myth about how the Americans spent millions and millions and millions developing a pen that could write in space because, of course, there's no gravity, whereas the Russians just used a pencil.
I don't think it's a myth, though. I don't think so. So anyway, some incredible repurposing of aerospace technology that's paved the way for incredible medical breakthroughs. So honestly, in time where progress seems to be trudging through mud, it's refreshing to look back and see that humanity, all in all, tends to strive towards making living here on Earth a better and healthy experience.
Charged now. You know, it's good for me. Right.
Ready to take on the rest of the week.
Ready to, indeed. Right. We've come to the end of the episode. And since it's Monday, what we'd like to do is suggest a few events that are happening this week that could make your week into an even more productive one. You can reserve your spot and buy your tickets to all these events by heading over to ptix.com. Right, P-E-A-T-I-X.com.
So first up is an event called Entering China's Market with Local Partners. It's happening tomorrow, June 6th at Work Glow Damansara. If you're an entrepreneur, investor, a business seeking to explore opportunities of business expansion, investments in China, then this event is for you.
Session will be focusing on the following: a deeper understanding of the Chinese market and its culture, tax and legal related matters in China, connecting attendees with valuable connections who can assist in their business expansion, investment, or even career opportunities in China, and finally, potentially exploring China to connect with local partners like suppliers, manufacturers, software developers, investors, and customers.
You can actually do this talk, having lived there.
I could.
You know, and this understanding Chinese culture, I know that like in different parts of China, it's so culturally different.
Oh, yes.
They may speak the same lingo. Anyway, this will also be a good networking session for those interested because you'll get to meet representatives from 71SG and their local partners from Malaysia and Singapore, reps from companies that have scaled and expanded to China, and the local Chinese government of Wuhan together with 71SG will also be shortlisting scalable early stage startups that can potentially pitch and raise funding in July 2017. So you'll be able to inquire more about this opportunity during events and think about 1 billion people.
Right. This event starts at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are 25 ringgit or 35 ringgit if you're buying in pairs.
And then happening on Wednesday, 7th of June, is an event that's very near and dear to us as BFM Edge. They're running a course called Email Marketing Engaging Your Subscribers. It's also happening at Work at Gold Damansara and starts at 9 and ends at noon.
Right. So we're often bombarded by sales emails on a daily basis, right? How many are open and read? Not many, I can tell you that. But when done correctly, an email marketing is one of the most effective prospecting methods because you're reaching your intended audience. That's why BFM Edge is organizing this hands-on workshop with Get Response to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of your email marketing campaigns. You can explore ways to build a solicited subscriber list, to design your email for more conventions, and to write a copy that converts prospects.
So this course will be conducted by Melissa Lee, head of Malaysia for Get Response, and she's experienced in building startups from ground up in logistics, customer service, finance, and marketing, having been part of the pioneer team for KFIT, Solar Malaysia, and many more. So, you know, an early Get Response is an email marketing platform that operates globally with offices from Poland to Russia. Early bird tickets are at 21 ringgit, and again, you can book it via ptix.com.
Also happening on Wednesday, 7th June, an event called Speak and Present to Influence. It's taking place at the Learning Centre in Mid-Valley. Join Johnny Ishak, a successful, versatile and fun speaker from the UK. He's also a member of the John Maxwell team, qualified to lead many of John Maxwell's training programmes. Participants will get clear exposure to what makes a highly effective speaker and will learn the pitfalls to avoid as well as the powerful habits to embrace when speaking in front of others.
Right. And of course, if you know you're an entrepreneur, you're always thinking about pitching and improving your presentation skills. This is one place you can raise your confidence, enables you to move from fear of public speaking to seeing it as an opportunity. So topics include demands of the presenter and speaker, from fear to fun. That should be fun. High impact visual, crafting your presentations, standing out and embracing your style, and pitching.
Indeed. Tickets from 399 ringgit all the way up to 1,000 ringgit, depending on the number of people and early bird rates. Email inquiry at QEMASIA.com, or just head over to PTIX to get your tickets.
Okay, and finally, Trend Micro is organizing an event called Wanna Cry Ransomware? What to Know Before It's Too Late. It's happening on Thursday, this July 8th, July or June.
June.
Anyway, right, at 9:30 a.m. at Trend Micro's office in KL. So admission is free. So we've covered WannaCry a lot recently on Tech Thursday and Five for Fortune. But if you'd like to get a little more info, feel free to check this event out. By the way, if you missed parts of this episode, don't fret. Just head on over to the Apple App Store or Google Play, depending on what kind of phone you use, the right one, I hope, and download the BFM app, which is now also available on Apple's CarPlay. And we'll post out all the links to all our stories on our podcast page.
All right, who've we got coming up on the Breakfast Grill? Who's that?
We've got that. Oh, very good. Datuk Kamalul Arifin Osman, Group Managing Director and CEO of Pelabuhan Hartanah Berhad. It was on the grill this morning. You want to talk more about that then?
Oh, no, we can talk more about that. Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Property is, property is certainly popular among Malaysian investors, and out of that asset class, this company aims to spur wealth creation for Bumiputras. So the CAO will be talking about that. So that's coming up right after the 1 p.m. news.
There we go. And that's a wrap for this episode. Check in again tomorrow for another episode of Biz Bytes with the all new lineup of stories to keep you up to date on the world of business and tech. For Frida Liu and myself, Rich Bradbury, on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.